quickly, as always, a couple of things. I want to thank Chaim, who sent me this. He's another person interested in walking down the aisle. There you go. The Lubavitch Rebbe at a wedding walking down the aisle. So you see that we have more of those. Also, two of you, Mordechai and Baruch, corrected my Yiddish pronunciation. Truth is, I didn't know this word that was where Rav Shach called Rav Shlomo Fischer. The word is kalaka, like an ignorant person or something. The thing is, it's not just me, and it's not a German word, so I didn't recognize it. In the diary, or not the diary, the memoir, which I can send to anyone, the person who transcribed it also apparently didn't know Yiddish because he actually transcribed it as Kal Yeker, K-A-L-Y-E-K-K-E-R. So there. At the end of class, the very last comment, the private one, came in about Thanksgiving and you know, the problem with the natives that we overtook. After, when I listened to the class, I thought of something interesting, which I forgot to mention, I didn't think of it. It's about a figure that we've spoken about in this class a number of times. We have, here he is, for those who remember, Rabbi Leopold Greenwald, Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald, rabbi in Columbus, Ohio, the author of the famous Kobo Alavegos, which every rabbi used to have, his standard work, but author of many, many other works, both halachic and historical. And here I'll show you a picture from his youth with his children, which somehow Rabbi Pinny Dunner was able to discover. There he is. The youngest one right there, Jack, he passed away earlier this year. And we spoke a lot about him in a previous class. So why do I mention that? Well, because lo and behold, as we were, as I'm listening to the class, I remember something. This is another book that Rabbi Greenwald wrote, Sefer HaZichronos. He kept a diary of his time in World War I in the Austrian-Hungarian army. It's a very interesting work. You can see it on HebrewBooks.org. I mean, he's an Orthodox Jew. He is, like so many of them, was a patriot, a Hungarian patriot. You get a feeling, a description of how he joins the Hungarian army to fight for the fatherland, thinking he's Hungarian like everyone else, and then for the first time really discovers real anti-Semitism from fellow soldiers and officers, with some exceptions that he mentions, who don't regard him as Hungarian. So why do I mention this? Because on page 26, he's talking about how, you know, you're saying that we don't belong to this land, Hungary. He's saying that we have more right to this land, namely Hungary, than the Christians. He's talking to someone, and the person asked him, how is that possible? And this is what Rabbi Greenwald says. He says that he's saying to the Christian, you came here 1,000 years ago from Asia. And that's the story, how from Hungarians, the story on our trip to Hungary, the guy tells it. The idea is that the Magyars, they followed is that how you pronounce it even, the name? But they followed this bird that brought them to Asia, to Hungary. And he says, you took the land from the nation that was here before by force. And that's, of course, how every country was formed. He says, we came here fine just a few years ago, but we are here based upon, we bought it basically because we were always taxed and always had to suffer and all these things. So we earned it, as it were, through paying through all these taxes. So I thought that was an interesting perspective that I hadn't thought of. And since I mentioned him, let me just mention one other thing that I think you'll find of interest. From this book, on page 40, this is the sort of thing that wouldn't go in the Art Scroll translation if they did. Well, first of all, on page 72, this also probably wouldn't go in. He's talking about how he was robbed one day, and lo and behold, even his ring The ring, Tabas Shozav Me'etzba'i, the ring he wore was stolen. So here you see Rabbi Greenwald. Granted, he wasn't a posek at that time. He's still, but he's a Talmud Chacham, young man, historian. He wore a wedding ring. But on page 43, for those who want to check it, he tells this interesting story that when he was young, this is before he went to Pressburg, when he was in Cheder, he tells a story how him and his friend went to steal oranges. There was an apple tree in the garden of his Rebbe. So they went to steal it. Now, the idea that he's acknowledging that he stole as a youth, that's what I mean. It won't be included. But he tells the story that he climbs up and his son is he's climbing up to get it. And lo and behold, the rabbi comes out and he immediately comes down from where he was standing to grab it. And he says, is it possible that you were going to make a bracha on thievery, on geneva? And if you're going to tell me that you were going to eat it without a bracha, of course, you know you can't benefit from this world without a bracha. So what does Rabbi Greenwald say that he responded? He says that I have some nuts here, which I bought. I was going to make a bracha on the nuts because they belong to me, and I would include that bracha, also the apple I was going to steal. And that's it. And then he says, when we returned, I told our friend, and everyone laughed about it. But it reminds me of Augustine. Augustine's famous story, which everyone talks about. Augustine, he tells in the Confessions, a work, by the way, which Rav Aaron Lichtenstein highly recommended. He said, we have nothing in our literature like the Confessions. And the reason is because Baalei Tshuva are not supposed to talk about their past. It's unusual. Today, of course, they write books about it, but traditionally you wouldn't write about it. You're supposed to be embarrassed by the sins. But that's for regular people. But even the great rabbis, there's one, Rabbi Wolbe, for instance, he was a great Musar figure in Israel. The Haredi press had to cover up the fact he came from an irreligious background. But so we don't have such a concept where, a rabbi who comes from an irreligious background would write about this. At least we don't have yet. Augustine talks about how once he, as a youth, he went into this orchard and just took a bunch of pears. And he describes how, the confession is all about how he was a sinner as a youth, that he didn't take the pears because he wanted to eat them. He took the pears because it was fun, just to make mischief, just to do something bad. It's like people today who just go break windows. Why are they doing that? They're not getting anything just for the sake of doing the evil action. And, so I don't know if that's Rabbi Greenwald, but because he was going to eat the apple, but it reminded me of it. And finally, one last thing. I've been holding on to this question for a few weeks, but now I see I have 5 minutes, so let me answer it. I was talking a few weeks ago about conservative, modern Orthodox, and I don't know which class it was. I must have said, modern Orthodox, eating fish out, something like that, eating out, which used to be very common. So someone emailed me, forget who, Jeffrey, I don't know, whatever. Someone emailed me asking, when did this begin with the modern Orthodox eating out? And I have to say, what I'm going to say now is going to be perhaps surprising for the people who don't know that much about history. Those whose only education is in the Haredi world, you're really going to be surprised. You ask, when did it start? The question isn't, when did it start? It always existed. If you look through Jewish history, one thing you find is that you always had people of different levels of religiosity. From a historical standpoint, the modern Orthodox community we have today of different levels of religiosity, that is the way Jewish communities always operated. The notion of a completely yeshivish, Haredi community like we have today, even the Hasidim, by the way, in the early years, you had different levels of religiosity. But this idea that we have today of completely religious, when I say religious, ritualistic religious, now plenty of these Haredi communities are full of ganavim, but I'm just talking about completely ritualistic religious, that is a very, very new concept. How do we know this? Well, first of all you have to do, for instance, is look at the drashot of the rabbis. You see what they're criticizing. You can look at the takanot. Communities throughout history made various ordinances. You couldn't do this, you couldn't do this. For example, the Maharal, for those people who don't drink non-Jewish wine, he gives a special Mishaberach for, and those who do, he curses them. And you have over and over examples of this. So I want to give you a very good example. It comes from the Tshuvos here, the Marshal. It's a famous tshuva. A lot of people know it. It's number 72, where that's the famous tshuva where he deals with wearing a kippah, where he argues very strongly that it's not a halacha, it's only a minhag. But I'm not concerned about the yarmulke now. I'm concerned at the end. He says as follows. He's talking about what he sees as hypocrisy. And he says, you have people, and he's in the, this is the same time as the Shulchan Aruch. He's, listen to this. He's saying that I'm going to expose the shame of the Ashkenazim, the Jews among who he lives with. Misha shose those who drink non-Jewish wine in hotels of non-Jews as inns. And those who he's going to expose the hypocrisy of those Jews who drink non-Jewish wine and also drink, eat fish out. We all know that expression in their utensils. People give these people kavod, v'nogim b'kavod, if they're wealthy and important. On the other hand, if someone were to be seen eating kosher, but he's not wearing a hat, then they regard him as someone yotzei min haklal. But here, so leave aside the yarmulke thing, the Marshal, Rishon Meloria, is pointing out that in his day you had Jews, leaders of the community, who would eat kosher food made in non-kosher utensils. We know many Jews in that part of the world drank non-Jewish wine. So you think it's something new? It's not. They didn't go out to restaurants. People didn't go to restaurants. I once heard Chaim Soloveitchik say that in a talk when he gave on his book article "Rupture and Reconstruction," he I don't know why he mentioned this, but he said that his parents never went out to restaurants. And then he said that he saw in Norman Podhoretz's autobiography, Making It, I think it was called, that he said his parents also never went to restaurants. There's something about maybe the old European, some people didn't feel comfortable going to restaurants. So what he said is that the Rav and his wife never would go to a restaurant. They'd like to eat at home. Very different than, of course, today, where we all like to go out to restaurants. But when you were traveling, then you had to eat at inns. So the Marshal is saying these people, they travel, and we have many, many sources of it. So when Jews were traveling, they never would eat pork, of course. They wouldn't eat non-kosher meat, but they would eat fish. They would eat kosher fish made in non-kosher kalim, things like that. So much so, by the way, that the Novi Yehuda came up with a heter that he says that travelers should be regarded as in a bidyavad situation. And if that's the case, you could probably make the argument that you could eat in the kalim, because you assume if you don't know that the kalim were used for non-kosher, you could eat in them. But we know that again and again, non-religious Jews would cut corners, especially when they traveled. So if you ask when the modern Orthodox, which isn't so popular today among my generation, definitely not the people living in New Jersey and New York eating fish out, but of the older generation, and maybe when you leave the New York area, there it's just continuing a tradition in quotes. I'll put tradition in quotes, but it's not something new invented by the modern Orthodox, let's say 100 years ago. That's my only point. Okay, everyone. We are picking up. We have a lot to do here with Rav Shaul Lieberman. I forgot to mention something last class, so let me call it to your attention now. Where is it? Oh yeah, okay. We spoke about Lieberman and his time in the seminary. I should have mentioned that in the 1950s, there was a Harvard University made a play to bring Lieberman, or at least people at the Near Eastern Language and Studies made a play to bring Lieberman to Harvard. And the story is told by Professor Frank Cross. He was a leading scholar, a biblical type scholar at Harvard. And I'm quoting now from a letter that Professor Bernard Septimus wrote. You'll also see the story, a little different version, in the Shochet book on page 146. But they bring Lieberman to Harvard for the interview. And who does he interview with? Another genius, the youngest dean ever in Harvard's history, none other than McGeorge Bundy. But if you know who that is, the older people will remember him because, as Frank Cross says in his letter, that after this disaster of an interview, which I'll describe in a minute, Bundy went on to graver errors in government service as one of the architects of American policy on Vietnam. But the youngest dean in Harvard's history, for whatever reason, it was not a good interview. The story, as Lieberman told to Cross, or McBundy maybe told to Cross, was that when McGeorge Bundy, not McBundy, McGeorge Bundy asked Lieberman, well, what would his position be called? Lieberman said, Professor of Rabbinics. And Bundy's reply was, we're not training rabbis at Harvard. And for a few reasons, as described, it wasn't a very good interview. In fact, it's possible that Lieberman was only doing this as a favor to Frank Cross, that he never really intended on leaving the seminary. But in any event, I wanted to call that to your attention. I want to begin by quoting something that's Spiro mentioned on page 47 and 48. Lieberman told the following story at a talk that he gave in honor of Alexander Lieberman. He focused on an important moment, at least from his perspective, that he had at the seminary. Now, when I say important, because this is so significant, and we know who the kid, the person he's speaking about is, but had he been teaching at Yeshiva University, or had he been at an Orthodox, at a yeshiva, he would have had experiences like this all the time. But look, it was so moving to him precisely because of the seminary. He tells about how he was about 10 days ago on a Saturday night. I was walking to the seminary. It was a lovely night. He mentions how he goes to his office on the fifth floor. And then he begins to hear a loud voice, the voice of Torah, someone learning out loud, the Gemara tunes. And he said the voice attracted him. And he went to the door of the student, knocked on the door. And the student answered and said, Professor, I probably disturbed you by studying a loud voice. No, I said, you didn't disturb me. I immediately thought you had come across a difficult passage and I might help you. And then Lieberman continues in his talk. I must tell you that this kind of study, the voice of Torah, that had the genuine longing of our ancestors for the Torah, brought back to me the voice of the yeshiva of the old country. It was gratifying to see that this boy was American-born, a son of one of our graduates. I could not help but reflect that as long as this goes on at the seminary, as long as these mysterious ties between the ivory tower of the fifth floor and the floors of the dormitory continue, Od lo avda tikvatenu, our hope is not lost. And we even know who this is. If you look on page 100, they tell us, Spiro tells us, and Shochet, the student, is Hillel Silverman. I don't know who Hillel Silverman is. I don't know if he's the son of Israel Silverman, who we spoke to. We're seeing Rabbi Kelman saying no. But Hillel Silverman tells the story, the exact same story. And then there's a postscript where Lieberman says, repeated this story and says he couldn't believe that he was a young man, American, late on a Saturday night. He wasn't going to a Broadway show or doing anything else, but he was learning. So Lieberman was very impressed. But as I said, he didn't need to be so impressed if he was at a regular yeshiva. It's the fact that the seminary, this was unusual. On the same page, let's see, page 48. Yeah, just that they mention here that Lieberman was frequently guilty of denigrating conservative pulpit rabbis and questioning their erudition. For Lieberman, his problem wasn't with pulpit rabbis. His problem, and that would be with any denomination, his problem was with people who saw the pulpit as a career, and that was the point. We all know, you know, cases like this. That is, for Lieberman, Limud Torah has to be centered. And then, as a Talmud Chacham, you work as a Rav. That's great. But to go into it, I mean, today we might see nothing wrong with it. Some people go into the rabbin just because they want to help people. What can I tell you? If you told Lieberman you want to go into the rabbin, look, I don't think most people in the Orthodox are saying you're going into it to make money. Maybe in the conservative, you can go make money. I don't know today with the sort of shuls closing down, but there was a time that a conservative movement, you can make a very nice living. Orthodox rabbis, some of them might make a good living, but they don't go into it to make a living. But if you would say, I'm going in because I want to help people, some of my good friends are rabbis. If you ask them, they probably would say, I want to help people. But that for Lieberman, even that's no good. That might be a form of, you know, spiritual self-centeredness, but it's not what it's about. What it's about is to be a Talmid Chacham and to want to learn and to want to teach Torah. And then you do the other things you do. So that was Lieberman's perspective. Okay, again, we don't have to necessarily agree with everything Lieberman held. We know, of course, in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, going to the rabbinate was not a goal. The idea of a seminary was something they hated. At the end, if you had to become a rabbi, so you learn Yoredeya, but to actually train to be a rabbi, Chas v'Shalom. I want to return to the last thing we were doing, though, last class. I should have started that. Remember, we went through the whole story with Lieberman's discussion together with the Rav. And the Rav told this whole story that Lieberman said that they found a scroll where a Kohen can't be Metame from a Sheretz. And he asked Lieberman, do you take this seriously? And Lieberman said, yes. And the Rav said, people like Lieberman in the Chacham Sashar school, they speak of different traditions, whereas this is Amaratzus. So what is Lieberman referring to? Well, this now I have to thank Shama Friedman. Shama Friedman has an article never published, but it's called Professor Shaul Lieberman, Harav Yosef Be'er Soloveitchik. Shama Friedman, who's American, 95% of all his writings are in Hebrew. So it's really, he begins by talking about how he only went to a few shiurim of the Rav at Moriah and how impressed he was by the students of the Rav. But then he goes through this whole story. And this actually, what Lieberman was citing comes from the temple, something called the Temple Scroll. It's an important Dead Sea document. And really, I think that the story somehow got mixed up a little bit because the Temple Scroll goes further. For the Temple Scroll, even a non-Kohen is not allowed to be purposely be metame to a dead animal. And if you do, of course, then you have to purify yourself. So Lieberman probably mentioned that and said that all the more, obviously, certainly a Kohen. And the Rav, in telling the story, just repeated the Kohen aspect of it. But I have to say, I don't understand the Rav's position. Obviously, the Dead Sea sect is a different, it's a different tradition. We don't accept it as an authentic tradition, but it's not Amaratzus. It's, there's different traditions. The Sadducees have different traditions also. There could be Amaratzim in each of these groups, but that's not what it's about. There are different traditions. And we know that very well. Chazal recognizes different traditions. So I don't know why the Rav, if you tell me it's one of the Gaonim, I get it. But that's not the story. The actual story, as it's told, is with something in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Lieberman, something that all of his students recognized is his great respect. And this also you see from his background, his great respect for the Tanaim, the Amoraim, the Rishonim. If you look on Spiro on page 217, 216 to 17, they tell a story about Baruch Levine, Professor Baruch Levine. He's a Bible scholar. He edited, I think it's Vayikra in the JPS Bible translation. But lo and behold, Levine gave a sermon. As a senior, they'd give sermons, and the faculty would be in attendance. And during this sermon, Yaakov did not come out very well. He doesn't say exactly what he did, but maybe he focused on how Yaakov tricking Esav or something like that. And Lieberman was very upset with this. In fact, the following Monday, this happened on Shabbos, the following Monday, they tell the story that Lieberman didn't begin learning Gemara. Instead, he launched into a discussion of Levine's drasha. And he state that this is not the way a rabbi should speak about our people. Then he says, would an American politician vilify Abraham Lincoln? Of course, this book was only written by Spiro and Shochet in 2005, when, of course, it was unimaginable that you vilify Abraham Lincoln. Now we have members of politicians who want to take down Abraham Lincoln's statue, if you can believe it. But at least before the country went insane, no American politician would vilify Abraham Lincoln. And you see here, Lieberman, the idea that you're going to be critical of Yaakov Avinu, and we'll see some examples of this in a minute, where he says to Solomon Zeitlin, you see the traditionalism of Lieberman. this isn't how you speak about these people. He didn't, on 217 also, they mentioned that he couldn't tolerate people referring to Tanayim by their first name, unless that's how they're called in the Mishnah. Hillel obviously is called Hillel. Rabbi Hillel is someone else. As I mentioned before, for years Brandeis University, and I told them this, and they didn't. But I don't know if they still have it. They would, if I am only for me, who am I? They would quote Rabbi Hillel, not Hillel. But Rabbi Hillel is someone else. He's best known for saying if there's no Mashiach, because the Jews already got it in the time of Chizkiyahu. But they mentioned here that if someone were to say Akiva. Some people refer to Akiva. You can't call him Akiva. He's Rabbi Akiva. Lieberman would point out to them, do you know him personally? You're going to call him Akiva? This isn't something you see from a typical academic. In fact, when they write, they refer to him as Akiva, even Finkelstein. Finkelstein's book is called Akiva, Scholar and Saint. Incidentally, Finkelstein. He was Lieberman was very critical of Finkelstein. First of all, he was critical of certain things in that book, but as I recall, but very critical of his book, The Pharisees. Lieberman, I mean, Finkelstein wrote a book, The Pharisees. Although Finkelstein and Lieberman were very friendly, Lieberman, when it comes to scholarship, he could be your best friend, but he tells it like it is. The Pharisees is Finkelstein's Marxist. That's the best way to put it. Interpretation of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So the Sadducees as representing the elites, the Pharisees as the masses. Lieberman strongly criticizes the way, not just from scholarship, but just the way he deals with it. He's not showing proper respect. You see this very, very clearly. Oh, he might, and also on page 218, they quote Spiro and Shochet quote Dov Zlotnick, and he testifies about Lieberman. I know that his respect for the Rav and Rabbeinu Tam was boundless. I once asked him, Zlotnick once asked Lieberman, did they really know more of rabbinic literature than you? That is, did the Rabbeinu Tam really know more than you? And he replied, they never went to the theater. Zlotnick says, that said it all. There were distractions in his life that were thrust upon him and others that he chose for himself, such as reading the Wall Street Journal. Lieberman, I guess, we read the Wall Street Journal every day. But he refused to accept the idea that he could know more than any of the Rishonim. And we see a good example of what I'm talking about in a letter, two letters actually, which I published in Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, that Lieberman wrote to this individual. His name is Solomon Seitlin. Solomon Seitlin was a character with a capital C. He, Yeshiva Bachur, who then gets a doctorate and becomes an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls, not Dead Sea Scrolls, sorry, in Second Temple Judaism, writes a lot. But once the Dead, he's famous or infamous because when the Dead Sea Scrolls came out, and started being published late 40s, early 50s in particular, and this went on till his death in the early 70s. He became the leading academic opponent of the authenticity of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Nothing could change his mind. Carbon dating, where they were found, what levels. He argued that they're medieval texts. They're not texts from the Second Temple. And it became a laughing stock eventually, but every issue of the Jewish Quarterly Review, he would review every single book that came out the Dead Sea Scrolls and try to show the ignorance of the authors. And I mean, you can see he's wrong. Everything he says is wrong, but he was on a crusade. He actually influenced someone. Professor Honig of YU got on this as well. He was a student of his from earlier on, and Honig also. Was on this false crusade, but he just wrote a few articles, nothing like Zeitlin. Now, Zeitlin had earlier taught at Yeshiva College, and it created troubles with the Rosh Yeshiva. You can see this on in Rakefet's book on page 141 and on. He tells the story here that Chorev. The 1938-9 issue, March 1939 issue of Chorev, has an article by Zeitlin called Haprushim, the Pharisees. Now, I looked in the article. I skimmed it. I didn't read it. It's an attack on Finkelstein's book, The Pharisees. I didn't see what was problematic that got the Rosh Yeshiva so upset. But he tells the story here how the Rosh Yeshiva, led by Ramosha Soloveitchik, were furious that they said that this article is replete with denials of the oral tradition. They demand that you recall this volume of Chorev and discontinue its distribution. I'm told it's a very rare book, but you can see a copy on HebrewBooks.org. There is one other YU publication that's a collector's item, and that there's an issue of Beis Yitzchak, but that's, I don't know if that's on Hebrew Books, but it's on Otzar Chachma. Two YU students, Eliyahu Stern and one other, has published a piece in which not only is Lieberman the Grosh, but Shama Friedman gets all the titles, and I'm told the Roshi Yeshiva were furious and they wanted to recall it, but copies still remain and you can now see it online. But Ramosha Soloveitchik wrote to Revel, "We are surprised that you, as the person responsible for all the activities of the yeshiva, permit the publication of articles which are completely against traditional Judaism, as expounded in the oral tradition of our sages." So Zeitlin, he wouldn't have been able to stay, I think, very long at Yeshiva College. Eventually, goes to Dropsy. Dropsy was this institute for the training of Jewish scholarship. Then it was taken over by University of Pennsylvania. You can read about the end, really the last days of Dropsy in this new book by Stefan Reif, I think is how you pronounce his last name, famous for the Geniza, expert in the Geniza. He just published an autobiography, and he was there for a year or two in Philadelphia towards the end when Leon Katch was the son of Reuven Katz, who later from NYU, but he was the president of it. It was taken over by Penn, and it became known as a research institution. It became known as the Annenberg Institute. And now it's the name Dropsy doesn't exist anymore, and the name Annenberg doesn't exist. It's just part of Eastern Pennsylvania. Someone has to explain to me how is it that people give a lot of money and their name disappears. But whatever it is, Dropsy no longer exists, but Dropsy put out the Jewish Quarterly Review for all those years, and Dropsy had great scholars there, and it had Rav Frischl Schachter's father, Melch Schachter. His PhD is from Dropsy, and many others studied there. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I'm just going to check this right now as you're with me. Yes, Revel himself. Exactly. I just checked it. Revel himself had his PhD at Dropsy. That was before Zeitlin was there. Incidentally, Rav Schachter's father's dissertation is on the Mishnah and the Bavli Yerushalmi. So let's say you're in the 50s and you wanted to get a PhD in Jewish studies or cognate, let's say Second Temple, Dead Sea Scrolls, then you'd be in trouble, Dead Sea Scrolls, but Bible, you could go to Dropsy, and it was a special institute just devoted to that, and very good faculty members and many good students. Well, I found in the archives of Yeshiva University a file that said Solomon. I got to get back there, but because there's still files I want to see. But I went to YU, it's probably 10 different times to see various archives. They had a whole list. They had a very nice index that was put together. And I sat there. It only would open, I think, as I recall, 12 o'clock. So from like 12 to 4, then I have to leave because otherwise you get caught in the traffic leaving New York. So I went there like in 2 years, probably 10 times, and I found all sorts of great stuff, and a lot of it which I published, including the letter from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky to Rav Nassim Kamenetsky that he gave a copy to Rabbi Harlap, explaining that really he should be at YU teaching because he'd have the most influence. But the problem is if he teaches there, then his sons are going to want to know why they can't go there also. I published that letter. I have found much stuff there in the archives. And lo and behold, I see a file. It says Solomon Zeitlin. Why is there a Solomon Zeitlin file? The only thing in the file are two letters from Lieberman. Solomon Zeitlin has nothing to do with Yeshiva University. He was long gone. He left Yeshiva College in the 40s. How these letters end up at Yeshiva University archive, no one seems to know. But they're there, and they're long letters, and they're amazing letters. And I published them in the appendix to Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. They have to do with the context, and the substance has to do with the calendar controversy. Article that Zeitlin wrote about the calendar controversy between Rav Sadia Gaon and Ben Meir. But I don't want to get into that per se, the substance. I want to speak about now the way Lieberman rebukes Seitlin, because in Seitlin's article and other stuff he wrote, he did not show in Lieberman's mind proper respect. So, for example, Rav Sadia Gaon, in this dispute, he claims that the real method of determining the months is by the calendar. That's the original method from Sinai. And Kiddush HaChodesh is only something later. It's almost impossible to read the Gemara this way. And but that's what he holds, not just him. But incidentally, Rabbeinu Hanano holds the same thing as well. But Seitlin, in discussing this, says as follows: it's deplorable that Sadia, in refuting Ben Meir, distorted Talmudic passages and advanced untrue hypotheses. And then he also says about Rav Sadia that he believed that the end justified the means. What's the end? Dealing with the Karaites. The Karaites were trying to say that we're all messed up in our holidays. We have it all wrong because we're relying on this phony Kiddush HaChodesh. So Rav Sadia Gaon's at it was saying no, that the calendar is the original thing. And Zeitlin was saying that in order to defend against the Karaites, Rav Sadia Gaon is making up these phony stories and he's lying about the meaning of the Gemara. Now, this type, and Lieberman is going to argue that although Rav Sadia Gaon's position is almost impossible to justify, he did have a way of reading the Gemara, and then Lieberman shows how he read the Gemara. But the fact that you'd accuse Rav Sadia of distortions and the end justified the means. Rav Sadia is one of the greatest Torah scholars we've had in history. And for Zeitlin to say this about Rav Sadia is too much for Lieberman to bear. And he writes him a long, two long articles, in which he doesn't just pick up on this. He picks up with on how he mentions the Rivash and others. He shows that Rav Sadia read the Talmudic sources differently. Leave that aside, but he says as follows. This is what he says. And listen, pay attention to the dig at Zeitlin. Lieberman says to him, "I know Gedolei Yisrael, those who learn the Talmud from beginning to end, and not selected sections for the sake of research projects, or that which they find in the writings of others." He's assuming, he's saying to his excitement, you get all this information from someone else. "And only rarely does one find that they overlook a point. Yet it's impossible that a chacham like Rav Sadia would build a complete system and repeat it and ignore explicit Talmudic text." And then he subtly taunts Seitlin. He says, "I say to you again, you treat Gedolei Yisrael lightly, those for whom the Talmud was ikar, main, and not tafel, not secondary, and you accuse them of falsifications without any basis. I repeat my words," he says at the end of the letter. "No one is saved from errors, and I don't exclude myself from this, but be careful with the honor of our teachers and our sages." This is not an academic speaking. This is a traditional Torah scholar speaking. On page 20, he says as follows: "I say to you again," these are two separate letters. He said that you accused Gedolei Yisrael, Rishonim, I'm talking about Gaonim, bezayufim, of forgeries, of falsehoods. He accused the Rivash of doing that as well. And he accused the Rivash, Seitlin, of creating a girsa from scratch. And Lieberman says, even if the Rivash is the only person who had this girsa, which isn't true because he shows that Rabbeinu Yonah had the same girsa, he says, "Ein choshtin adam gadol v'kasher kamoso bezayuf nusach ha-Talmud." How can you criticize someone like the Rivash of a zeal for forgery? He says this is not only a terrible thing, avel enoshi, v'hashim b'li yisod, but it's also not scientific. You see in these letters, which I encourage anyone who knows Hebrew to read, who's interested in this, because you see Lieberman, not just as the academic, you see Lieberman basically telling Seitlin, Professor Seitlin, no offense, but you're an ignoramus. And not only are you an ignoramus, you're disrespectful and don't know how to treat great Torah scholars. And he says to him, he does say, he says, "There's nothing personal here. You've never done anything bad to me. You've never abused me, but I just have to say it like it is." And that was Lieberman. His approach, though, to the great Torah sages here is so far removed from modern critical scholars. More point along these lines on page Oh, just I noticed in terms of how he relates to Gedol Yisrael and how Gedol Yisrael related to him. One more point I just saw, I should have included this earlier when I did it, but I just saw it today. On page 114, they quote Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, reported from his son Ronason, quote, "Lieberman is an extraordinarily erudite and expert scholar. I never met anyone with such piquet, such breadth of knowledge." So we remember the story where Yaakov speaking to Lieberman at the wedding, and Rav Aaron said not to. I now want to turn to some of Lieberman's two important works, namely Greek and Jewish Palestine and Hellenism and Jewish Palestine. These books, you can get them now. They reprinted them in one nice volume together. So it's both of them with an introduction by Zlotnick, 1994. They're not synthetic treatments of the subject. They're chapters. Each chapter can be read individually as an independent study. You can see from the titles, one deals with Greek language as seen in rabbinic sources, and the other is Hellenism. Zlotnick has a nice introduction on page 7 of his introduction. He points right at the beginning that all these works, Hellenism, Jewish Palestine, Greek, the Talmud of Caesarea, Shakeian, Yemenite Midrashim, all his articles, these are just ancillary. His major writings are Talmudic commentaries, Tosefta Kevshuta, Halachot Yerushalmi, those sorts of things. But these were side projects, as it were. Pretty incredible because he was very, very prolific. If you look at the articles in Hebrew and English, academic articles, there's a lot there. Later in this introduction, he points out, Zlotnick points out that Lieberman, and we'll see this later in the book, I think, that he repeated this in his classes, that Chazal were men of their time. What does that mean, men of their time? They're modern. They accepted the science of their day, provided it didn't clash with Jewish law. And an example he gives is astrology. The fact is that they did accept astrology. And if you would have rejected astrology, Lieberman said that you're rejecting a science that's accepted by the Greeks. Now, there were opinions he mentions that holds that astrology has no authority over the Jews, but they still accepted astrology as existing for others. And then he points out that while the rabbis combated superstitions that were forbidden by Torah, nevertheless, they accepted those charms, kameo, whatever was sanctioned by the science of the time. So this is an important principle. Of course, it's the Rambam's principle, that if you see a scientific description in the Talmud, that's simply the best science they had at the time. Now, I want to go through certain aspects of, just call attention to things that come out, strike me as of interest. Let's begin with just let me here's the chapters in Greek and Jewish Palestine: the Greek of the rabbis, the Greek of the synagogue, Gentiles and semi-proselytes, pleasures and fears, oaths and vows, misunderstood expressions and words, Greek and Latin proverbs in rabbinic literature. These all deal with, if you don't know Greek, which I don't know, it's really tough to see the brilliance and the significance of what he's pointing out. There are some cases where you don't need to, which I'm going to show you. Then I'm going to show you an example. It won't be this class, it'll be next class, where using the Lieberman approach, you can show, I'll show you something in a much later text, the value. But I just call your attention to a couple of things, first in Greek and Jewish Palestine, and then in Hellenism in Jewish Palestine. Well, on page 110 and 111, Lieberman rejects the idea, the notion. Everyone assumes that the Babylonian Talmud has many more incantations and superstitions, we call them today, than the Palestinian Talmud, the Yerushalmi. But he doesn't think so, and he thinks the reason you don't have more stories like that is because the Yerushalmi is much shorter. What he's trying to argue here, he thinks it's all these superstitions are not really superstitions. This is simply what advanced science believed. And therefore, just like in Bavel they believed it, so too that in Eretz Yisrael they would believe it. Although I don't know if other scholars agree with him, because there were certain ideas. I don't know if you call them superstitions in those days, but there were ideas that were accepted in Bavel that weren't accepted in Eretz Yisrael. On page 164, this is of interest. And I'm not, it doesn't deal with Greek. Well, he uses a Greek word later on, but you don't need to know Greek for this. He mentions that Rav Avram ibn Daud, there's three Avram ben Davids. Famous one is the Ravid, but the other one is the author of Emunah Ramah and the books Sefer Kabbalah, which is he's early, he's before the Rambam, but this is a historical work. Gerson Cohen published the translation, the edition of this. Avram ibn Daud in Sefer Kabbalah says that Vespasian and his stepson Titus. Who was called his son. So he even says, where does Avraham ibn Daud get this idea that Titus was Titus in Hebrew is not a son, that he's a stepson? Where does this come from? We know that's not true. Lieberman says, if you look in the Sifrei, it has this passage. It says, Titus Harasha ben Ishto shall us. Posidonus, Titus the wicked, the son of Vespasian's wife. And what Liebman expands upon here is the rabbis didn't intend to say that he really was a stepson. What are they saying when they say Titus Arasa ben Ishto? That is Titus the son of the wife of Vespasian. Rather, this is a way of mocking him to show that, well, who knows, maybe he really isn't his son, that that his mother wasn't faithful to her husband. It's just a way of putting down. It's like we might say son of a then B or something like that, to put someone down or call someone a mamzer. They were saying that Titus is a mamzer. I think in English we usually refer to him as Titus, right? In Hebrew, I only know for Hebrew we call him Titus. They're saying basically that he's a mamzer. Not to take it literally. I thought that's a very interesting insight. As he says, it's very probable they sought to express the contempt and suggest for Titus and suggest that he's not, the mother was his, Vespasian's wife, was not beyond adultery. It's the author of the Sefer Kabbalah who didn't sense the sarcasm of the expression and took it literally. Very interesting. Now, more interesting to me is Hellenism and Jewish Palestine, which isn't as technical with Greek terms and everything. Let me read you. You'll get a sense immediately why I find it more interesting, or at least for me it's more interesting. Just listen to the titles, and then I'm going to give you some examples. Yeah, I see this is taking longer than I thought really coming. I thought I'd get to mine. Wait till you see my example from the Shulchan Aruch. You can use the Lieberman approach to explain the text. But here are the chapters. Texts of scripture in the early rabbinic period, corrections of the Sofrim, critical marks in the Hebrew Bible, those dots that you have over certain words, the 10 dotted place in the Torah, rabbinic interpretation of scripture, hermeneutic rules of the Agadah, publication of the Mishnah, alleged ban on Greek wisdom, rabbinic polemics against idolatry, and goes on and on. Let me I skimmed it through it today and just picked up some things that I think you'll find noteworthy. He explains right at the beginning that whereas Greek and Jewish Palestine, he points to Greek phrases, technical terms, but in this book, he wants to trace Hellenistic influences on the behavior, rights, practices, conceptions, and literary methods of the Jews. Literary methods. We'll see some examples of this. On page 25, he speaks about, the whole chapter, he's speaking about, correction, it's texts of Tanakh, texts of the Torah, really. We've seen already in his discussions of Midrashic literature, he believes that you can't so easily say that texts are mistaken. Rather, we say that there's different traditions. So if you have two versions of the Midrash, two versions of the Mishnah, you say in many cases each represent different traditions. And he talks in this chapter here, texts of scripture in the early rabbinic period, that you had the same thing with the Torah. The rabbis say in the Talmud, you can't use a Sefer Torah that's not corrected. Lieberman explains that you had popular versions of Tanakh, including the Torah, And then you had official versions. You had vulgar texts, like I guess you could call it. And that these are variant texts which didn't have, the especially when you get into Nach, there were corrections made by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola or the so people called the Sofrim. We have Tikkuni Sofrim. We'll see what this means in a second. That not all of them made their way down to the masses. Furthermore, what begins as a mistake over hundreds of years then could become a variant text. When you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls and you see variations, significant variations in Nach, not in Torah, but in Nach, are you going to say those are mistakes? How could they be mistakes? It goes on. You have not just a word here, a word there. You have whole psukim. You have in Ashrei. You have for Nun. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, it gives you the answer. It has the verse for Nun. But you have real different versions. These are not just copyist errors. These are alternate texts. So how were these alternate texts created? Well, then you need to examine. You need to go back. At one point in time, of course, a new text is created. But when you're already in the Second Temple period, now these are variant texts. These are tradition. And who can say which tradition is which one? There's a few places in Halacha, in Sifrei and elsewhere, they talk about how they put in the Beis HaMikdash, they put three Sifrei Torah, which were to be the letter perfect text. So if you have any questions how it should read, you go there. The problem was that in these letter perfect texts, they didn't agree. There was a few words. So they described what they did. They went by the majority. They, if you in these mistakes there, they went by the majority. So then what about the text that differs from the majority? Is that a copyist error? Could be, perhaps. Although it's hard to see if you have different words, meaning the same thing, just different words. It seems that these are old traditions, and that sets the standard. When you have mistakes in the Torah, you decide based on the majority. We don't have this issue anymore, because all our Torahs are basically the same, and if they're not the same, like you put it through the computer, it's a copyist error. That wasn't the case before the creation of printing. On the contrary, when you see a Rashi, for instance, or you see in the Gemara where they quote a pasuk and the pasuk is different than what we have. I'm talking in the Torah now. Forget about Nach. This isn't necessarily just a copyist error. We have, for example, throughout Ashkenaz, they would have, let's say, an extra vav here that we don't have. This is a different tradition, which is not in line with the Masoretic text as we have it. But who says it has to be in line with the Masoretic text? So that this is very much in line with Lieberman's approach. On page 31, well, in the chapter, his whole chapter, Corrections of the Sofri, this gets us into the question, there's something which we know as Tikkuni Sofri, where we're told that the scribes, who are Ezra, Anshei Knesset HaGdola, it's not clear exactly who it refers to, presumably Anshei Knesset HaGdola, made corrections, not just in the Torah, in Nach as well. So what does this mean, they made corrections? Well, you have some texts that say that this is just a euphemism. It doesn't really mean they made a correction, but it means that it's the text was written this way as if you would think it was a correction because you could read it differently. On the other hand, you have texts, Midrash Tanhuma and others, the Aruch, that are explicit that Anshei Knesset HaGdola actually altered the text of the Torah. This creates all sorts of theological problems because who gives them the right to correct the Torah? That's once it's given. But Lieberman says that you have to take the texts at their words, that what we have here are two separate traditions. Again, two traditions. You have the tradition of what they call Kina HaKatuv, where it's not a literal adjustment to the words, but then you have, as is stated explicitly, not just in Midrash Tanhuma, but the Aruch and all sorts of other sources, a separate tradition. Now, how are you going to figure this out theologically? Plenty of people have already discussed this. Apparently, Anshei Knesset HaGdola had this authority according to this tradition. It's not for me to explain the theology, but that's, and Lieberman himself isn't explaining the theology, but to say we can't just get rid of texts that are there. And when the rabbis tell us explicitly that these are corrections made by Ezra. There's other examples. You have an Avos Rabbi Nassan. The whole Avos Rabbi Nassan says that the dots over the words were there in case Ezra needed to correct it. And Ramosha Feinstein said, this is Kefira. We mean Ezra. Ezra doesn't have the authority to correct it, but that's what it says. And if you look in the, take out your Gemaras, look in the back of Avos Rabbi Nassan and take a look at the Binyan Yoshua. That's the standard commentary in Avos Rabbi Nassan. He says explicitly that Ezra had the authority to do this. So that's Lieberman's point. Again, we've seen this again and again, that when you have contrary texts, don't assume that there's a mistake, especially not in this case, when not only do you have the Aruch, you have Midrash Tanchuma, we have Masoretic notes, numerous Masoretic notes that state explicitly that this is a Tikkun Sofrim of Ezra. What you have to assume is that these are separate traditions, and then you can work out the theology. As Rav Shlomo Fisher said, the great Rav Shlomo Fisher, in response to Ramosha Feinstein, Ramosha Feinstein criticized Rabbi Huda Chassid. He said that Rabbi Huda Chassid doesn't have to accept the Rambam's eighth principle, and he didn't. He believed that later Nevi'im could also add things. That's what Lieberman would tell you is going on here with the Midrash Tanchuma, that from that school, that the Ezra and remember, Anshei Knesset Gedolah also includes Nevi'im. They had the authority to make alterations. Why? Who gave him that authority? Again, that's something to look into another time. But as he says, quote, the two opinions, namely that Tikkun Sofrim means euphemism, or Tikkun Sofrim is real, actual, cannot possibly be reconciled. We are confronted with two divergent views of two different schools. We have no right to adapt one rabbinic source to the theory expounded in another rabbinic book. We must consider the sources as they are, independently of each other. Let me give you one more example. On page 78 in Hellenism, he deals with the rules of interpretation. We know we have Gezeira Shava, Kal Vachomer, there's 13 modes of interpretation, Rabbi Shmuel says. Others give different numbers of interpretation. Lieberman says that there's no evidence that the rabbis borrowed any rules of interpretation from the Greeks. However, when you deal with formulation, terms, categories, systemization, these do come from the Greeks, and the Jews did not hesitate to take them over and adapt them to their own rules and norms. So here it's important to know the distinction Lieberman is saying. The Greeks also, you had terms that sound very similar and ways of classifying that Chazal did. But this doesn't mean, Lieberman says, and in saying this, he's disputing with other scholars. There were other scholars who said that the whole idea of a Gezeira Shava is taken from Greek ways of looking at texts. And you know, there's ways of examining Homer and things like that. Lieberman is saying there's no evidence that any of the methods of interpretation are not internally Jewish things. However, the way they're described, the way they're classified, the way they're organized, that, of course, they used Greek ways, just like we would use general scientific ways of organizing and putting things into categories. The only exception, obviously, to what Lieberman is saying would be Kal Vachomer. Kal Vachomer is just simple logic. If something works here, a fortiori, it works more. If you can violate Yom Tov, if you can violate Shabbos, in this case, certainly you can violate Yom Tov. That's just using simple logic. If a Jew could do this, is allowed to do this, a non-Jew could do it. That's generally, of course, there's exceptions. What I want to do next class, I see time went faster than I thought it would, so I'm going to make a mark here. There's still a few things in Hellenism and Jewish Palestine I want to show you. Then I want to give you an example from the Shulchan Aruch, something that many people listening to the shows have probably looked at and have seen, and yet the word is incomprehensible. But if you adopt the Lieberman approach, in this case, it's not going to be Greek, it's going to be Latin. You can understand something and it makes it all clear, makes sense. And of course, and again, you can use this. The late Yaakov Ellman, he was doing, if he wrote a book, it wouldn't be Persian in Jewish Palestine. It would be perhaps Persian in Jewish Babylonia, because he was doing the exact same thing. He was adopting the Lieberman approach, with Hellenism, but instead of looking at the Tanaitic sources, he was looking at the Amoraic sources and saying, what can we learn about the Amoraic sources and Halakha and Haggadah from the Persian environment? Lieberman did the exact same thing with the Greeks. And then after I show you my example from the Shulchan Aruch, then I want to talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about Heschel and Lieberman and something Boyarin says, go through the just a couple more letters in my booklet, and then get to the big issue where Lieberman again jumps. Hopefully we'll reach it by next class. So I thought maybe next class would be the last one. It'll be, we'll go one more class because we have to really give it some time here. I want to speak about the issue of women rabbis. It's not where it comes from, the origins of it. It's not reform in America. This goes back, not only does this go back to Germany, and you had a similar situation in Germany that you're going to have at the seminary, Orthodox faculty member not wanting to give smicha. I'll even tell you about American Orthodox female rabbi. You talk about the conservative, the trends in conservative Judaism and general American society. Lieberman is asked by his top students, faculty of the seminary, about women rabbis. Will read his responsum, analyze his arguments. Do the arguments stand up? Are they halachic arguments? Are really the arguments from Masorah, which is just using halacha, but it's really not a halachic argument? And then I'm going to show you what I think are some interesting, I guess you could say, repercussive aspects of this, how this has played, and where we are in the Orthodox world on this matter of women rabbis, and how we come to the place where Herschel Schechter, in looking for justification to forbid women rabbis, halachically, not from Masorah, actually turns to Lieberman. And that really is going to take us to the end of the semester, although maybe if we have time, I'll talk about Lieberman's final article. I should talk about it, actually, so we'll add that as well. His posthumous article, the attack on Jacob Neusner, and I have the new biography on Jacob Neusner. Talk a little bit about their relationship. And I also found stuff in the Lieberman archive from Neusner. And it doesn't matter if we finish. I have a whole pile. I have like 15 emails I still haven't gotten to, even from last semester. So if we have a half hour left, I can go through those. So let's count on perhaps two more classes. But I'm having fun, so I don't need it to end. Let me get the questions here, the comments. Bill Gewertz says that a fearless, empty-headed student asked the Rav after Shiur in 67 about something in Kobol Avelos that the Rav violated. The Rav said he knows as much about Avelos as I know about, unable to plead the sentence, welcome to the elevator. There's a whole story here, apparently. Apparently, I'm forgetting now the details, but Rabbi Greenwald said something negative about something of Moshe Soloveitchik. I will get you, supposedly, that's the story that, hold on a second, let me look at my files here. If I can just, but it does, okay, so here, I found it. It's David Berger also reports that the Rav tore apart Greenwald, and so he said it's the worst sefer, it's the weakest sefer. So the students wondered, of course, what is it? What did Greenwald do that got on the Rav's crosshairs? Well, Greenwald writes as follows, that it pains him to read. There's someone doing a doctoral dissertation on Rabbi Greenwald, so I got this from him. It pained him to read, he wrote in the Der Morgen Journal, that after the death of a famous rabbi and Gaon, burial was, and talk about it in 1941, December 41, burial was postponed until Sunday, so more eulogizers and people could attend. And he says that he assumes Greenwald is talking about the Levaya of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I'd have to check, though, to see if that's, let's see, Moshe Soloveitchik, he dies. He dies January 31st, 1941. So it doesn't the dates are not working out correctly. But he wasn't sure in any event if that was that's what he was told. Put it this way, there's a story that Rabbi Greenwald says that, and it has to be checked. Is it true? Was Rabbi Soloveitchik's funeral just delayed for a day? That at least the story is that the Rav thought that Rabbi Greenwald was criticizing delaying the funeral. Now, I'm a little suspicious of this because Rabbi Greenwald mentions a rabbi from Brooklyn. And he doesn't say who, but a rabbi from Brooklyn. Moshe Soloveitchik was never in Brooklyn. He lived in Manhattan. Whatever it is, if you ever crossed the Soloveitchiks, they don't forget it. I was told by an eyewitness in the Rav Shir that the Rav went crazy when someone mentioned the Ridbaz of Tzfat. He started screaming. He screamed that the Ridbaz, there's some Gedolim who are always right, some Gedolim who are sometimes right, and some Gedolim who are never right. And the Ridbaz is never right. Well, if you know what the Ridbaz said about the Rav's grandfather and his method of learning, but the Rav was going crazy, screaming. This is taking us back to the late 40s or early 50s. So we understand that. Baruch says perhaps it was a different type of ring. Not every male or female ring is a wedding ring. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was a different ring. But today, the very idea of wearing a ring for Hungarian Rav would be thought strange. Rabbi Mazuz says, I told you this a few semesters ago, when he got married, his father bought him a ring. Because in Tunisia, that you wore a ring. But when he came to Israel, he saw that the Haredim didn't wear rings, so he took it off. I showed you pictures of Gedolim. Yeah, Frank Moore Cross. That's exactly what I'm referring to. Rabbi Shunau says, Professor Seymour Siegel, author of Tradition and Change, emphasizes the difference between unhechshered and unkosher. Unhechshered is not necessarily unkosher. That is correct. If lots of food don't have hechsher, if you go to Europe, they don't have hechshers. Everybody should know, you know, as having traveled the world in Japan and other places, you don't have hechsher on food. That is correct. Susanna says there are people who, when planning their careers, weighed the rabbinate versus medicine. Yeah, what can I say? Lieberman didn't see the rabbinate as a career. He thought Torah learning is what you should be doing. And then, as a Torah scholar, it's natural that you be a Rav. The idea of a career, but it's not just him, the typical Lithuanian Torah scholar, the idea of rabbinate as a career. That's a very modern thing. And look, it's a very nice career. You're doing a lot of good. But for a traditional mitzvah like him, the idea that you think of it as a career, they would mock the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, the idea of a seminary. That's not a yeshiva. Someone privately asked me, are you sure the Rav knew about the Dead Sea Scrolls? I don't think the Rav knew about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but he knew what Lieberman told him. The Rav in the speech says that he heard from Lieberman that they found a scroll. Now, when he refers to the scroll, he's referring to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Lieberman told him about this. Bill Gewirtz says that Baruch Levine taught at Stern College in the late 50s. My sister was in his class. That I find interesting. He certainly was not teaching what you'll find in the JPS commentary on Leviticus. That I can be pretty certain on.
That surprised me significantly when I still read his commentary.
And the fact that he has a PhD also, but it wasn't a, you know, let me take that back. You say it wasn't a, I'd say that you think that having a conservative smicha would be a psul. But there was a, I don't need to repeat it, but the people who I'm talking about, but a lot of people know, you had a very, very great Talmud Chacham who also had conservative smicha, who ended up teaching at Yeshiva Talmud at Yeshiva University, was a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. So, I mean, if it was in your past, they would hire you. So maybe what I told you from Professor Hyman, when he said he wouldn't be hired, who says? It's if you don't identify with the movement at present. Rabbi Shunau says Rabbi Hillel Silverman was a conservative rabbi, powerful conservative rabbi in California. He was the son of Rabbi Morris Silverman, who the Silverman sitter. Zahav says that Zeitlin has a young relative at U of T, University of Toronto, emeritus now, who just published a book on Eov. What's his name? Is the name Zeitlin? I don't know. Oh, and Justin Hornston says that Nachum Sarna has a PhD from dropsy. That is news to me. I didn't even know that. He worked at Dropsy, as I recall also. That's right. He did have it. I think he worked at Dropsy. Then he became the librarian at the seminary. Yes, and Nachum Sarna, of course. Irving Zeitlin, him, I don't know him. Bill Gewirtz says that Professor Zeitlin walked into the Rav Shir as part of the Middle States Review in 68. The Rav said hilarious things, needling Zeitlin, like, what was Rav Akiva Svara? Don't tell me he had liberal democratic tendencies. My memory is not perfect. I recognize from the book cover of The Rise and Fall of the Judean State. And actually, Zeitlin is criticizing the Marxist interpretation of Finkelstein. But Zeitlin, it's not serious stuff. Let me tell you, he draws these conclusions, leaving aside the Dead Sea Scrolls stuff. He wrote some articles on Rashi and other things. He jumps to conclusions and makes these let me just give you an example of the nonsense Zeitlin had. Lieberman is criticizing him, and Zeitlin says as follows. After he criticizes the main stuff about him, he says that, and what about all these other things? You say that Rashi, when Rashi uses the word Yesh Potrim, there are those who offer this explanation, that Rashi is referring to Notzrim, which he says is nonsense. Or you say that it's known that Rashi often used the Yerushalmi. And he says, you say that the Yerushalmi invented a Braisa Shlema Baduya Min Halev. Just the Yerushalmi just invented a Braisa. So Zeitlin is coming up with all these crazy things. No one takes him seriously anymore, even at the end of his life. For a time, he also was involved with the Savonic Josephus. That whole controversy, but it was a laughingstock by the end. Today, like Lieberman said, maybe about Kabbalah, nonsense is nonsense, the history of nonsense is scholarship. Someone should write a study of Zeitlin, all the nonsense he wrote, and just this quixotic quest of his to prove the Dead Sea Scrolls not authentic in the face of everyone, all evidence. Bill says Rambam and Ramban both criticize Sadia on his view of the calendar. What they say is that they think that it was also done for polemic reasons, not that he really believed this idea that the real tradition is the calendar, not the Kiddush HaChodesh. So why is then Lieberman getting so upset with Zeitlin? I think because the language Zeitlin is using is much more maybe cynical. I don't know, though. It's a problem. Morris says that he highly recommends using Google Lens or similar, which will overlay the English translation of the Greek when reading. Okay. Rabbi Shudnov says that Lieberman pointed out when Chazal used foreign words, Greek, Persian, or Latin, there was something in them not communicated by the Hebrew or Aramaic. Okay, so someone asked me privately, why do I call the Talmud the Palestinian Talmud? Well, you can either, the Talmud is called two things. It's either called Talmud Yerushalmi or Talmud from Eretz Yisrael. So if you want to call it the Talmud from Eretz Yisrael, then you call it the Palestinian Talmud before 1948. Lieberman refers to the Greek and Jewish Palestine. So Lieberman is referring to the Palestinian rabbis and the Palestinian Talmud. As we saw, I showed you the Ginsburg. His commentary on Yerushalmi, the other side, the English side, is called the Palestinian Talmud. Palestinian didn't have the negative connotations that it has today. That's why he doesn't say Hellenism in Eretz Yisrael. It's Hellenism in Jewish Palestine. That was the name of the place. The Romans changed the name to destroy Jewish nationalism. So instead of calling it Judea, they called it Palestine. But Jews had no problem referring to it as Palestine. That's what it was called. Just like if you're from the Netherlands, I don't think you have a problem referring to it as New York, even though you might not like the fact that they changed the name. Morris says that in Greek and Jewish Palestine, page 92, Lieberman makes a claim which he found astounding, that Chazal sought to Judaize foreign elements and customs which had been adopted by the common folk. So let me get back to that next class. Maybe I'll tell you next class. I had mentioned this already months before. Rav Avram ben Arambam says the same thing about the Torah. The Torah, not just the sages, the Torah Judaizes practices of the non-Jews that were that people had adopted. Rabbi Shun, I was hoping to hear more about Professor Faor. I can't say that. In terms of Ellen says, in terms of postponement of burial, the Rav died on Thursday, the funeral was on Sunday, so that family could come in. You're allowed to delay a funeral. The problem was when they delayed it, it was Erev Yom Tov. I was at the funeral. It was the last days of Pesach was then that night, so it made it difficult. But we know that you're supposed to bury immediately. And in Eretz Yisrael, someone could die, let's say, at 10 a.m. and it's burial by the afternoon. Even die even 2 in the afternoon, they'll bury him at 10 at night. But there's a heter for the kavod of the mace. So if people are coming in, or when the Ksav Sofer died, they delayed the funeral, so all the great rabbis could come and visit. It's happened. And finally, the last thing, as Rabbi Shunna says, Jews refer to themselves as Palestinians. Arabs were Arabs. That is absolutely correct. So Rabbi Kalman, take it away.
Yeah, if you remember, we were in Frankfurt. Hirsch also, I think, was also, they delayed his burial a couple of days. I think he may have died on a Friday and buried him on Sunday, if I correct. But it's on the tombstone, which
Yeah,
is
we
quite
saw this. Look at
fascinating.
the tombstone.
Right. I mean,
This
his tombstone is interesting for all kinds of reasons, but they would put the date of death and day of burial on the tombstone. It's very kind of interesting how they did it. But yeah, of course, that's not unheard of at all. But okay, we look forward to next week and the week after, and then we'll see if we'll take it from there. Okay, and tomorrow back at 11 a.m. Rachel Danziger-Sharansky to continuing her series on relationships in Genesis. Rabbi Adler finishing up his 3-part series on the Rav on Hanukkah. That's at 1 p.m. So we've got 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. tomorrow. And then Wednesday, like I mentioned, Rabbi Alex Magid on cutting the baby in half, legal and Jewish perspectives. And then the evening, Dr. Sokolow on the Tanakh, putting the Tanakh together. And then on Thursday, Shuli Mishkin and the Parsha Shiur this week by Leah Silver, 8:30, and then my Shiur Thursday morning, Friday morning at 9 a.m. 9 a.m. on the Siddur, which we'll continue, finish up Al HaNisim, and maybe we'll do HaNerut HaLelumos, or we'll see how far we get. And so we do the Hanukkah parts of the Siddur. Okay, everybody, have a nice night. Hanukkah Sameach. Should hear good news, good things. And please invite a friend to join us, and be well. Have a Laila Tov.